When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
8603 of Manhattan Homicide to base, okay? 8603 of the 4th Homicide to Central, okay?
8603.
Do you have any message for this unit?
Negative.
10-4.
The voice of a real-life detective. Music of a television detective pointing towards 4th Homicide Squad Manhattan of the NPD, the New York Police Department. When I was there in late March, the precinct notice boards read 25 homicides to date, a normal, reasonable figure for the time of year. We were set for, as it happened, a routine and dramatic evening. No Kojak, no lollipops, no dark glasses, no sirens. An evening with the homicide squad, in particular with Sergeant Noel Biggins, who comes from Tuam in the County Galway. Sergeant Biggins knows New York like the palm of his hand, especially life as it is given and taken in Spanish Harlem.
You've got a high concentration of drug use and drug users living in that area to a concentration of people living on welfare.
Of course, you've got Central Park running down through the middle. Yeah.
And that is correct. And as you can see right now, there are no pins indicating any homicides. But with the warmer weather, you will find we'll have 3 or 4 homicides from that area.
What causes that?
Well, you get an influx of transients, people who live rough and who sleep in the park at night. Many of these are drug addicts, or also concentration of alcoholics come in there because of the comfortable surroundings. Mm-hmm. And you have disputes amongst them, and that's where you'll get your homicides.
What causes most homicides in your own experience?
Well, mostly working in the 4th here.
Yeah, I was wondering what makes people kill.
Well, most of our homicides in this area evolve around disputes, whether they're between husband and wife, or disputes over, we'd say, in drugs or money. There's very few for revenge or, you know, for hire.
It's not as dramatic a thing as one thinks, perhaps.
No, it's. I would say not. Not definitely not as dramatic.
Family argument.
Mostly, quite a few. Emanate from family arguments.
And indeed, Sergeant, looking too over here at your list, for example, of killings, say, mm-hmm. last year and the year before, mm-hmm. the word gun, it figures all the time.
It's the weapon of choice. It's predominantly used in our homicides. You'll find that gun and knife are the most common weapons.
Is the gun that easily accessible in New York?
Well, New York has got one of the more stringent gun control laws, but the states adjoining New York have got very liberal gun control laws, and as a result you just pass over the state lines and purchase it in one of the adjoining states. And then again too, if you want to buy an illicit gun, there are quite a few in the immediate area. They're floating around the city.
What types of gun do they use? Do you have a regular type?
Mostly what we call handguns. They go the whole gambit from Saturday night specials, which are very cheap type of gun, usually a .22, which are more danger to the user than to the person that's been used against. And then you go from quite a few sawed-off shotguns, shotgun is an accessible weapon in New York, and all you got to do is take it home and saw it down, so you got a concealable weapon there. And then again, you get the very sophisticated Berettas and other revolver-type handguns.
Now, you've got several factors there described as physical force.
Physical force. That can be any type of force. Can be result from using a blunt instrument, could be leg of a chair, broom handle, or it could be just strangulation or your own fist, which is good enough to inflict death.
Now, you also have a list there, and there are, I think, is it four names in the same family?
Yes.
How did that come about?
Oh, that, in this instance, it was a common-law husband had a dispute with his wife, or common-law wife, and bludgeoned her to death and her son, and she was pregnant at that time, and the fetus was at a certain stage of development, so it's classified as a homicide also. It died as a result of the beating.
What was the end product then at the end of the trial and so on?
Well, this subject has yet to go to trial. To the best of my knowledge, he was charged with three counts of homicide.
In general, what happens if they're convicted?
Well, normally they go away to do considerable stretches of time. That's our, all our endeavours are channeled at. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully they... Usually if they plea or if they found guilty, I would say manslaughter one, it should be 25 years to life. But more often than not, they'll get manslaughter two, and which would be 15 years to life.
Do you find that people say maybe, who come out on parole, that they can strike again? There's a pattern.
Well, that's true. We find recidivism is very prevalent amongst our criminal population here in New York. In the homicide area, it's hard to say, though. It's not uncommon that a guy may have no prior record before committing his first homicide. They say your better parole risk are people who have been charged with homicide. But in your other crimes, you will find that, especially in the area of robbery, that you will find that most people have extensive records, and for the same thing, robbery.
Now, you showed me some horrific pictures there.
Yes.
Of a girl who died.
Yes.
Now, what actually happened to her?
Well, she was bludgeoned to death. And then later on she was thrown from a height.
And the police officers come along on the scene then, is that right?
Yes, John.
It makes me think that a police officer wants a very strong stomach.
It's an asset at times if you do have a strong stomach, especially if you get the arrive on a scene where a body has been in a locked room for a period of time with varying degrees of temperature. It usually takes only a couple of days and it becomes decomposed. And at that time you do... It is a help if you've got a strong stomach.
Now, as we're here, there's a suspect being questioned in another room, and you were showing me a bloody footprint. How did you come by that?
Well, when we arrive on the scene, after the ME has pronounced him dead and that the death is a result of a homicidal act, we bring in our forensic team, and they search the area thoroughly for anything of an evidentiary nature. And this bloody footprint was found at the scene, and it's got the potential that we may be able to match it up with a suspect later on.
And perhaps your suspect here might be the one.
That is true, it's possible.
What's the technique now for getting information from him? Question, question, question?
That is correct. You go in and you ask him to account for his time, and a series of questions. There's no fixed formula or a pattern. You've got to play it by ear with each individual subject that you bring in.
And do you have two officers doing the questioning?
Normally you would have two officers in that... one officer may be able to develop a tact that the other officer he didn't think of, or he decided to leave it up to his partner to follow that.
Do you use this all sort of, what would you call, Mutt and Jeff technique, one pleasant officer, the other kind of heavy?
Yes, that is correct. It's used.
And is that effective?
We'll find at times it would give you good results.
Detectives' day room in the 6th homicide zone is bare, functional. Three desks, three tables, files and the inevitable. Inevitable for America, that is, coffee. Black, strong and always necessary. There too, sitting quietly, was a large man, his trade quite unmistakable. Detective Officer Jack McCarthy. His family came originally from Ballydehob, County Cork, what he called Den O'Mahony country. But both he and his father before him have graced the ranks of New York's finest.
Well, in 1956, I started off as a foot patrolman in Harlem, which was a difficult assignment. I stayed there approximately 9 years, and I was a big man, so naturally I got along all right. And people up there generally don't bother Irish people because they know we like to fight, and that's a good thing on our behalf. Even if you're a calm fellow like myself, it's a good thing to have behind you.
Did you come across much violence in the streets in Harlem?
Well, I've seen quite a bit of violence over my 22-year career, especially in those ghetto areas. There was quite a bit of violence, everyday violence.
What type of violence now was the most common?
Well, in Black Harlem, you would see more shooting. In Spanish Harlem, you see more knife cutting. It seems to be that they do the damage to each other. They very seldom bother a police officer, even though once in a while you do hear of police officers getting hurt and people getting mugged, but generally they do it to themselves.
Were you involved in any kind of incidents during those years in Harlem?
Well, I was involved in three race riots that had in the early 60s. There was a general uprising, I guess, all over the world. Students and Black Harlem, people demanded better housing, which they got. And there was a lot of rioting, a lot of shooting, a lot of people got shot. I didn't shoot anybody. I was afraid to pull my gun. I thought I'd shoot myself.
Difficult time to be a policeman, though, wasn't it?
It was. Not really, because I was born in New York, and I was born in the streets. I was born in an Irish neighborhood, and Black Harlem was also not an Irish neighborhood. It used to be an Irish neighborhood, and I heard what it was, and the streets were familiar to me. I didn't live too far away from this area myself. I lived in the city at that time, and it was enjoyable to work there, because I used to be at work in 5 or 10 minutes, and back home again to the safety of a nice, quiet Irish neighborhood.
And then after Harlem, where did you go?
Well, after Harlem, I was assigned to a plainclothes dude that was investigating mafia individuals and suppressing gambling and prostitution and that type of work, surveillance.
What areas would that have been?
Well, that was in Brooklyn, because there's a concentration of mafia figures out there. I was there for a year, and I went to the Bronx, then the Fordham Road area. I was there 3.5 years.
Now, in working and dealing with the mafia, more difficult than Harlem, I suppose.
It is, really, because it seems that their group is a tightly knit group. It's hard to get into their areas because they keep their neighborhood strong. Being an Irish guy and tall, right away, when I walk in, I'm a sore thumb, they know who I am. But the idea is, as long as I know who they are, they can't get away from me.
The mafia is very much a family thing, isn't it?
Well, I don't know so much about family. Not being raised with those type of people. I know that they are interconnected, that it seems that when one guy goes wrong, he's taken care of somehow. They always end up dead. You can observe it in the street. You see one fella who's moving in on someone else's territory or doing something wrong. Next thing, he's dead somewhere, blown up in a car or whatever.
So that was the mafia. They were controlling, I presume, prostitution, were they, drugs?
Well, they say that. God knows what they control. Now they stay out there with their big suits on. I think generally that they have never got educated to move into the business world, so they just control their own little things, slot machines and bars and grills, and anything they can get their hands on, protection, anything like that, gambling.
Was prostitution very rampant where you were?
No, I worked on the prostitution detail. I can't tell you what we used to call it, but we worked in that detail. I didn't really relish doing that. I didn't like narcotic work either. I did a little bit of that. It seemed to me below my standards. I didn't really relish that type of work at all.
So when did you come to homicide then?
Well, after playing clothes, I went to the 19th Detective Squad, which is the east side of Manhattan. And that was general detective work. We worked in all cases, from misdemeanor cases to anything, even homicides, robberies, rapes, everything, you name it. Homicide then came in 1971. The department decided to specialize in homicide because homicide was on the increase in the city, and I was selected as one of the elite members of the police department, you may say, to join the 4th Homicide Unit. I've been here since.
Can you remember the first homicide you came across?
Yes, my first homicide was up on 110th Street in Madison Avenue, and there was a person shot in a social club. And I went to the club, and naturally, I'm not a Spanish-speaking person. This is a Spanish area. But no one speaks English, and you speak to these people, and they no comprende. The thing with those people, you have to go back every day. And every day I did go back there for about 6 weeks, and finally someone says to me, "Officer McCarthy, the guy you want is Raymond." And I went and I locked up Raymond.
How did that break come about? Have you any idea?
Well, I guess they figured I'd never go away, so they might as well tell me, because they have their little things doing too. Who knows what they're doing up there, hustle, they sell numbers, they take whatever they do, and they don't want me hanging around bothering them either, so if I just stood out there long enough, I figured I'd be a pain to them, so they finally told me.
I suppose initially for anyone, a police officer too, death under violent circumstances is a very horrifying and frightening thing.
Well, generally seeing death, as we do, we see it every day, it's like a doctor would see an operation in the hospital. We've seen tragic things. I've seen bodies dismembered. I've seen a police officer's bodies dismembered in 7-8 pieces all over the place. And it's horrible to see, but it's a thing you face up to. You go in there, you handle it, but you can't take it home with you, because if you start taking things like that home with you, it's a grim, you know, way to act with your wife, to look at her and look at your children. You have to be impersonal with the thing, but still you have to have a great concern and moral responsibility.
There must be fear too, Jerry, for the officer.
Well, on occasions we go out, when we finally get close to a case, on the initial investigation, we generally go to the scene. And every homicide, people must remember, there's a victim and there's a perpetrator. Now, the person who committed that crime left some trace. Being a mortal person, individual, you have to leave a trace of some kind. Either someone saw you, or you stepped on something, or there's a fiber of hair, or there's some trace. You have to investigate every homicide very closely and carefully from the scene out. And you can't disturb that scene until you get a technician in there to go over the scene with a fine-tooth comb, really look at it, and then slowly but surely work yourself out inch by inch from the scene. Sometimes these cases take a long, long time to break, but they go down because everyone leaves a trace.
Do you find that people under questioning become violent at all to you?
No, most people under questioning, they tend to lie if they're involved. But we use polygraph. We request people to take a polygraph test. And when they take their polygraph test, we know what we want. You see, we have certain keys that only the killer knows. In other words, when we release something to the press, we would tell them the body's on the floor, but we would never tell them that there was a knife in the chest, or there was a note, or there was some sort of like a bizarre blood writing on the wall or something. We would keep these certain facts to ourselves. So when we go down to a polygraph unit, we and the killer know about that. So when we have our polygraph technician ask these key questions, and that needle starts jumping, we know we got the right guy.
Does your work sadden you?
No, it's a very satisfying job. In fact, I have 22 years in, and my wife wants me to retire, and I'd like to retire, but it's so invigorating to come to work. You never know what's going to happen next. I know right now the city's in a stalemate to give us a raise. It seems that they're broke, and they want to break us, and we'll get along somehow.
Now I've got the tape machine resting on the press. Now, Jerry, what do you want to do here?
Now I'm
my thumb.
I'm going to make you feel like some of the people feel that I process through here.
You're putting my thumb on a black surface.
That's right, with ink. And I'm going to put you in, right in the ink, as they call it.
All right, that's the thumbprint.
That's
now.
You.
Well, that's
see,
me.
See your name right there?
Oh, they're interesting looking, yeah. This is the index finger.
A sly looking devil you are.
Indeed, you press right down.
Hands of a criminal.
Oh, my God, yes, yeah.
Tough fingers.
Yeah.
There we go, there's three.
There's three. Do people object, by the way, to this when it's being done?
Well, they can't object to it if ordered by law to take fingerprints. Sometimes if they...
There we go. We got the five.
No, that's only five.
Oh.
We need five
oh,
more.
Oh, I see. You got five more.
Not so fast, you know.
We're going to the left hand now.
Is that
ink, this surface?
It's in the ink.
We're rolling the thumb again.
Wrong
pressing it down.
That's right.
Index finger again. Press her down again. Are they good prints coming up now? There.
Look very legible.
They look very legible.
They look like you've been printed before.
Not in New York, anyway.
Well, we don't know. We better call Interpol.
Call Interpol. You might have a job on this in hands.
All right. We're not finished yet now.
No, they're the 10 anyway. What happens after this?
Now we put them all together.
Oh, you're rolling your... you're rubbing across again now.
Keep them out straight out together. This is only one set. We usually make three sets. This is from New York City, you see, in the top.
That's the left hand.
And then we make a state copy and we make a federal copy for the FBI.
This is the thumb. Now the right hand.
Right. Thumb first.
Thumb again.
Right.
Press it right down again.
Okay.
And then the four fingers together.
Push it down again.
And I'm completely dossiered now, am I?
Right. Now, this copy would be a New York City copy. Then we make a state copy and a federal copy. If you're
say for example, now looking at my fine black thumb here, what would you see as the principal characteristic there if you were looking for somebody? Or is it
well,
obvious?
You start with the arch in the middle.
Yeah.
And you need at least five or six ridges where you have it to read a print. You have an arched well, a loop. You have what they call a looped arch. Is that right, Sergeant?
It's like having a fortune told.
That is correct. He's got a looped arch there. It's very legible.
There are certain characteristics on there, quite
yes,
legible.
Yes, you've got your
You see the little twirl on there?
I do, yes, yeah.
That's classified as a loop. And then on each one, you've got so many ridges, and they count the ridges.
And I've got several ridges. I'm pretty well ridged, in fact.
Thank God they're on your fingers, not on your face.
Sergeant, we've seen a case there of a person who killed several, I suppose you'd call him a multiple killer.
A mass killer.
A mass killer. What type of character will do this?
Usually they're sex deviants, and usually mentally disoriented or suffering from some kind of a mental disability. Mm.
I suppose, Jerry, in this city you have lots of people living on their own, lonely people, old people who are quite susceptible to this sort of thing.
Well, that's right. Since the neighborhood concept of the city is broken down, most people are old, trust into these hotels where there's no one to take care of them, and it's really tough on them because God knows the neighbors can't take care of them, they can't even take care of themselves. And those are the people that would be susceptible to any sort of an injury or even getting sick. You know, they would fall there dead for days, no one knowing they're gone.
I suppose, too, you could have cases that might seem just death from natural causes and wouldn't in fact be that way.
Well, generally when we respond to a scene, we look for any break on a window, any sort of a larceny or any break on the door or anything out of the ordinary. We interview people if there's anything missing here, and sometimes we wait for the medical examiner and we get his report, and he's the person who classifies what a death is in the city. If he says it's a natural, well, it's natural. If we're suspicious and we think it's something else, we continue our investigation. If we get more evidence, we give it to him. If he wants to change his classification, fine. Most often he doesn't, because after all, he is a doctor, and he says we're only detectives, and we just do our thing, and he does his thing.
What's the approach in general to that sort of killing? Somebody breaks into an old lady?
Well, most people that would do a thing like that, like the sergeant said, are sex deviants, and they would pick on an old person because they notice there's no struggle. They may be just looking for a couple of pieces of change, some sort of sex, and they would suffocate the person by threatening them. If they say a word, they're going to kill them, and then they put a pillow over their face, and then the people next door, naturally they're old and sleeping, whatever, they don't hear the noise. The person will put the pillow over their face, hold it there a few minutes, then replace the pillow where it was, and sneak out of the apartment. No one knows the better of it.
Can you remember your first homicide case?
Oh, well, yes, but that's going back years ago when I was a uniformed officer on patrol. That's very, it leaves a sort of an indelible impression on your mind, your first one when you arrive on the scene.
Especially, can you tell us about it?
Well, it was, I believe, again, a boyfriend-girlfriend dispute where she just stabbed him once with a knife, but that one blow was lethal and the knife was still protruding from his body when I arrived on the scene.
Do you find that people perhaps who kill in the heat of passion, that they will admit practically straight away? Or not?
It would be very hard to make a cut-and-dried rule on that. As I said, nearly each investigation or each homicide is sort of unique in itself. In instances of, you know, people killed in the course of passion, you normally is not premeditated in that sense. And your criminal is not as, you know, does not try to conceal his tracks. So you've got an advantage there. But as to coming to you and blurting out, I killed him, that doesn't happen that often.
Also, too, of course, you rarely meet people when they want to welcome you. Isn't that right?
Well, yes, yeah, sad to say, in the case of police officers, the most time that they're in your home is under a crisis conditions. And, you know, we see people at their worst, and they see us as enforcers of the law, which is really wrong, because we're very human.
Do you have a rule of thumb at all yourself, or is each case so different?
Each case is pretty unique. You would, you'd be really going on the limb if you said they were all a carbon copy, because it depends on the deceased, depends on where the homicide took place, the type of what the homicide evolved from, if it was a dispute or if it was during the course of a commercial robbery or in a fit of rage.
What do you think you learned from death and stress and violence and homicide?
It's far too prevalent. That that some people take life very cheaply.
Do you find that your own insights into people have changed? Does it make you pessimistic to be dealing with this all the time?
Well, to be a police officer, you have to a degree of cynicism, and you find that just sort of become reinforced when you're in homicide or working with homicide.
And why did you join the police initially?
Well, I thought it'd be an interesting job, and it has been to date an interesting job.
Now we're talking about death all the evening along here. How do the Irish figure say in your homicide files here? Is there a high percentage or a low percentage?
I can say without fear of contradiction that we don't have any as of now in my file, and hopefully I won't have any. And you find here in New York City that they're one of your most law-abiding segments of your population.
What's the most frightening part of your job? I mean, you're called out in a case. Which one would you say to yourself, I better be particularly wary there?
Well, when you got somebody identified and you know he's got a history of violence and you possibly got him cornered in a room or you're going to pick him up at his apartment, you've got to be very careful how he is going to react. And it's very hard to say how he's going to react.
What sort of weapons would you use in those circumstances?
Well, normally, as I said, if we know enough about the subject that we're going to apprehend or we're going to bring in for questioning, if he's got a history, prior history for violence, you would be to your advantage to go out with a bulletproof vest, which we do. We have bulletproof vests, and we have sawed-off shotguns, which in close quarters can be very lethal, and they give you psychological clout at times.
How does Kojak seem to you, to ask you a light question for a change?
Well, Kojak, of all the TV series, or correction, police officer series on TV, he's more true to the real police scene than the others. The others seem a little over-glamorized. Though, sad to say, we're not as successful as Kojak. We we do not have a 100% clearance.
And I suspect, to a sergeant, you're hardly paid as much as Kojak.
Definitely not.
And so, on a dark, cold night in March, we leave the comfortable precinct and head out into the dank, glistening, half-empty skyscraper streets of downtown New York.
We're going to journey to the east side, and en route we'll pass through Central Park, which is one of the recreational areas in New York City.
And how long would it take, Sergeant, to get through your whole area in the car?
From river to river, it would take about half an hour. Yeah, so I'm constantly in touch with my command, and also I've got listen to the type of radio runs that are being broadcast for our division.
You were saying that oftentimes Friday night can be a busy night.
That is true, especially in the warmer months. You get an inordinate amount of work from, run-of-the-mill family disputes to catastrophes. The warm weather does contribute a lot to our work. A cold spell can be a very good ally for the police officer in that it keeps a lot of problems off the street. As you can hear, we use a lot of code words.
I thought they were code words. I didn't know what they were saying. Now, we're approaching a tunnel here, are we?
Yes, this is the transverse road at 79th Street in Central Park. And you just left Central Park West, which is quite a status address, and you're journeying over onto the east side, which is known as the Blue Stockton Belt. Some of your wealthiest people in New York reside in this part of the city.
Also, earlier in your precinct, we were talking to some of the officers, and people talked about officers working together. They're invariably in twos, are they?
That is correct. You normally work with a partner for safety reasons, and also to act in some instances as a corroborating witness when you may need somebody to witness you taking a statement or making an apprehension.
And can you often, quite often, get a dramatic message on that radio there when you're out?
Quite often, yeah. I've got one code signal, which is a 1013, and it means a assist police officer or a police officer in distress. And a call like that, you pull out all stops, and if you're within a, you know, several blocks, you will respond irrespective of the boundary lines. The only, you could, if you're just on routine patrol, and a signal comes over from the adjoining precinct. It is not your precinct, so you do not respond unless it's one of an emergency nature, like some an instant where somebody be in danger of being seriously hurt or something of that nature. But when the 1013, a signal, code signal 1013, is broadcast, you stop everything and you respond to that location.
Do you have a siren in this car?
Yes, there's a siren, and also there's a outside broadcasting system. I can pull motorists over by addressing my commands over the air to them.
Oh, it can be heard outside?
Yes. I better not, in that I might cause a little panic here. But this set here, you can normally pull somebody over without a lighting from your car.
And where are we now here?
We're now at 79th Street and Lexington Avenue. As I said, it's one of the more affluent areas in the city. A little further south here, you got Lenox Hill Hospital, which is quite a hospital.
Is there any particular time of night more dangerous than another in New York?
Yes, I believe they've pinpointed it to Fridays and Saturdays nights between the hours of 8 p.m. and 2 a.m. in the morning. And if you were to draw up a pattern, you would find that sort of the amount of incidences you have during those hours are very pronounced.
I talked earlier too to you about having to carry a weapon. You're supposed to carry it at all times.
That is correct. It's mandatory that we carry our sidearms 24 hours a day. That's if you're up and about 24 hours a day.
And do you do a training ever so often? You do?
Yes. There again, department regulations mandate that we qualify at least twice a year. And most detectives also got to qualify with the sawed-off shotgun.
Unit 223, at 314,
Unit back
out of
John.
That's a very busy radio, isn't it?
Yes, this is
one
command alone. It's the 23. As I said, it's got a heavy population, and it's a very busy location.
That's not a police car in front of us there, no?
That's correct. That's from the 19th precinct now. We're within the confines of the 19th precinct.
We're in 2nd Avenue now, are we?
That's correct.
Unknown weapons are involved at this time,
sir. This unit will be on that same radio that you're listening to right now. But as I said, this is the 19th precinct, and where most of the activity at the moment is taking place is up in the 23.
Okay, that's 314 East 106.
Now looking for a parking space.
Oh, is that what you're doing? Do you travel at any set speed when you're going around?
Patrol, the guidebook or the rules and procedures that, you know, outline the regulations, the department lay down that you should travel at 5 miles per hour, which sometimes is not very practical. You may cause a monumental traffic jam, or to respond to an emergency at that rate would be very foolish.
Wouldn't make the police any more popular than they are, or not, as the case may be.
That is very true.
It's a lonely enough job in its way, isn't it?
That is true. You find that most police officers, when they socialise or even leave the, you know, their commands, they socialise with other police officers. You find that civilians at times have a hard time relating to you. Mm. First and foremost, your crazy hours, and secondly, the type of work you do and the clientele that you normally come in touch with.
Don't you find too that civilians are a small bit afraid of you?
Yes, sad to say, which I would like it to be the reverse, that they were a little bit more cordial and a little bit more friendly.
we just heard there earlier on the call about stabbings.
Yes, code signal 1034 came over, which means that there is an assault in progress. And it's requesting units to respond to a location on 92nd Street.
Police car flashing in front of us now.
Well, this unit is not, it's a 19th precinct unit, and the unit they're requesting is a 2-3 precinct unit. In all likelihood, this vehicle is going to another run here.
Did you ever have a gun pointed at you with intent to do damage?
On several occasions, I've had the misfortune of looking down the barrel of a gun.
Is it possible to say how you would have felt at the time?
Very scared. Your heart starts thumping, and you're just hoping for some kind of a miracle. Unfortunately, in all the instances where I had
up to now, you've obviously not had anything.
I've been very lucky.
What's the police drill in that case?
In a situation like somebody pointing a gun at you, if the subject holding a gun on you wants something, you give it to him. If it's like a combat situation, you just pull your own revolver, if it's not already unholstered, and exchange fire with him if he's firing at you, and hope that...
I noticed tonight in the precinct a great respect for revolvers and weapons.
Oh yes, safety with firearms is emphasised, because, you know, one careless little act and you might do untold damage. And weapons or handguns are very fickle. You've got to, treat them right. So the regimen in the police department is that take great caution at all time how you unload and how you load your firearm and where you maintain it.
You keep yours down on your leg. Is that for ease of getting at?
Well, I wear an ankle holster in that. One, it is convenient to get at, and two, it saves wear and tear on your clothing, because if you constantly wear it in your waistband, you'll find that your waistbands expand and the friction on your jacket puts a hole in it.
This is why Kojic has so many new waistcoats, I suppose, in the series.
That's very possible one reason why he's got them.
Where are we now at the moment?
We're heading towards the 59th Street Bridge.
Driving over cobbles now. Yeah.
Cobblestones. This is what the old streets in the city were formerly made of. And you got here the tramway, which is a elevated tramway which leads over to Roosevelt Island, which is an island in the East River. And it's a very new community they've just built over there of luxury housing. Here you've got some of your most expensive housing in New York on 57th Street. Here you've got the Sovereign, which came in for a lot of notoriety lately. You had two people killed there by a couple of parolees.
Do you think often, by the way, we see the bridge now facing us, that your public and the media are not sufficiently aware of the difficulties facing police officers?
At times, they're apathetic to the problems of the police officer. And as I said before, the majority of occasions when we meet them are stressful occasions, and they have very few occasions to see us under happy circumstances.
How is your own public relations in the police department?
Mine personally, or the department's policy?
Mm.
Well, they strive at it. They're constantly trying to project a positive image. And as a matter of fact, we've got officers assigned full-time to it, usually under the title of Community Affairs Officer or Community Relations Officer. And they run like recreation programs for the children and so forth like that. And they help senior citizens, tell them how to protect their property and how to protect themselves from attacks, or if they're attacked, how to react. And we've got two or three new units in the department, and one of them is a senior citizen unit, and it handles crimes perpetrated against people over 62.
Do you have many officers who are killed in the job?
Yes, in past years we've had a pretty high mortality rate, but so far to date this year, no police officer has been killed, and hopefully that will be the statistic for the whole year.
Another element strikes me too. Surely in a stressful life like yours, it must make, for example, a married life a difficulty and lead to problems.
Well, married life, you need a very understanding partner. when you work in police work, in that your hours are very erratic. You may be scheduled to be home at 1 o'clock or 12 o'clock, and the case is just breaking, and you just got to stay with it. It may be 2 days later that you show up at home, and especially in situations where you got a young family, the whole onus is put on the wife to bring up the kids, and it is tough in that respect. As a matter of fact, police officers in the continent of the United States, they got a very high divorce rate, and some people resort to alcohol as a catharsis or a cure as well.
And you certainly have plenty of rain tonight, lashing here now.
Oh, well, hopefully it'll be to our advantage, and that'll keep crime off the streets. We find that weather is a great ally in police work. You'll notice in cold spells or when there's a heavy snowfall that your certain type crimes will be diminished greatly. And there again, too, during the hot summer months, you have a corresponding upsurge in crime, in that, you know, I got a lot of people on the street. There's more contact with each other, a lot more drinking, possibly just to quench their, you know, the thirst due to the heat. And as a result, you got many confrontation situations developing that wouldn't normally develop.
How often do you have medical examinations in your job?
Well, on entering the job, you have a medical examination, and every time you go sick over, you've got to be go to a police department surgeon. You just can't call up and say, I'm going sick. You got to be certified by a police department surgeon. And if you suffer any kind of an injury on or off the job that may disable your work, so it may limit your capabilities, you got to undergo a medical.
It's a very stressful career, of course.
That is without saying. It's very stressful.
Where are we here now?
We are now journeying towards 23rd Street. Second Avenue. Over here to our left, which you can see through the breaks in the buildings, you got Bellevue Hospital, which is one of the older hospitals in New York, and one of the better medical schools associated with it. It's one which has got a lot of contacts with police, in that most of your emergency situations are rushed to Bellevue. They're very capable and able in handling stab wounds and gunshot wounds and things like that. Something that the other smaller hospitals are not that familiar with.
And so I bade good night and good morning to Detective Sergeant Noel Biggins of Homicide. He returned to sign off and I returned to my hotel, as the rain dripping down the back of my neck was sweet music and the windscreen wipers of an unmarked NPD car, of course.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.